Hello and welcome to Zed Forward, a podcast celebrating authors and other individuals who are involved with the project for the benefit of Seton Hall University and the world around us. My name is Jerry Shea, and I'm proud to welcome our guest for today, Dr. James Daniel. Dr. Daniel is an assistant professor of English and director of basic writing and assessment in the English department at Seton Hall University. His research theorizes how the writing classroom can valuably explore issues of precarity, economic inequality, workers' rights, and he's the author of Toward an Anti-Capitalist Composition, published by the Utah State University Press, in 2022, a text that challenges the field of composition to come to terms with the capitalism's devastating effects and articulates a model of composition pedagogy framing writing as a critical, collaborative, and political praxis. And that is what we'll be talking about today. Dr. Daniel, thanks for joining us on the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Our pleasure. And before we get started with the book, maybe we can just talk a little about you and your past. How long have you been at Seton Hall?
So this is the end of my first, or the beginning of my second year.
Okay, cool. Year. Mm-hmm. Very good. All right, very good. And where did you teach before you came to Seton Hall?
A lot of places. Before Seton Hall, I was at University of Washington for about 5 years.
Oh, wow.
And then before that, at a bunch of different schools, Tennessee State, University of Texas at Tyler. So I bounced around quite a bit before I came here.
Before you got seen, okay, very good. And were you an adjunct part time? What was your working conditions?
Well, I was a tenure track professor at Tennessee State University.
Okay.
For complicated reasons, I left that job for personal reasons. It wasn't a good fit, and I ended up lecturing and adjuncting for about 8 years. And that's in fact what partially inspired the book. That kind of trajectory.
Okay, very good. Yeah, sure.
As academic, so yes. But now I'm on the tenure track again, and hopefully settled for good.
All right, very good, very good. All right, well welcome to Seton Hall. And what course do you teach here at Seton Hall?
Well, I work mainly in our first year writing program. So
okay,
that's mainly English 1201 and English 1202, which are the core writing classes mm-hmm. of our writing curriculum. But I also do some graduate teaching and also teach basic writing, which I also direct.
All right. Very good. Very good. And at the other university, you taught at sort of the same trajectories?
I mean, yes, I'm very much in the sort of remit of composition,
right,
although
gotcha.
I've done graduate work. Years ago did a graduate class on affect. I've done work on writing the discipline. So kind of a journeyman in terms of what I've done over the past number of years.
All right, very good. So let's get to the book. And what inspired you to write Toward an Anti-Capitalist Composition?
Well, it was essentially two things. The first was the history, the personal history that I mentioned. I left this tenure track job and found myself adjuncting and bouncing around a bunch of different positions and in this very precarious place and wanting to find some sort of way to make sense of my situation through some disciplinary literature. And what I found was that there essentially wasn't a lot of work about labor, about capitalism in composition, or rather there had been a conversation about capitalism back in the 90s, let's say,
right,
people like Richard Oman or James Berlin, John Trimber, who's still writing, Ira Shore, but that this conversation had steadily declined over the decades. And at that point in 2015, when I was beginning to have these thoughts, I just found that there was very little attention to these bigger issues of capitalism, of class difference, of economic inequality, or attention to how to bring these issues into the classroom. It just seemed like a conversation that we were not having as a field. And so that period really saw a turn in my work to try to begin a way of thinking about how to bring issues of, for example, debt or precarity into the classroom to talk with students about them. And that really became the genesis of the book, to think about how does this become central to our teaching? Why does it need to become central to our teaching? And then how might it inform other aspects of our institutional work, for example, or organizing? So essentially, it's that history of thinking about the conversation that we really need to be having in the field that brought the book kind of out.
Right. Very good. And boy, so this is going to this direction, and you bring it to students. What's the reaction from students when you bring this anti-capitalist sort of idea to them?
Well, it's interesting. There is some resistance, although not as much as one might think. I think that what's happening today is that there's a new generation that's emerging now.
Right, right.
And that seems to be much more interested in these kinds of conversations. They are hungry for a kind of conversation that speaks to their own experience and their own anxiety about their their relationship to student debt, for example, mm-hmm. or their career anxieties. And, you know, some of them have read Teen Vogue, which has become an increasingly radical magazine over the past couple of years.
That's interesting.
Or other kind of, you know, there's a lot of discourse on TikTok, for example, that's critical of corporations or capitalism. So
interesting.
A lot of students are kind of hungry for this. And I think what they've encountered in some of their educational experience is are classes that are very politically cautious.
Right.
You know, they might read a speech by Barack Obama, or there might be a little bit of work with civil rights rhetoric or something like that, but they're not really encountering something that seems to speak to the kind of exigent experience of students today, where they are facing down enormous anxiety and enormous uncertainty when it comes to the professional world, when it comes to housing, transportation, all of these things that are, I think, terrifying to them. And I think some of them do take to this kinds of conversations well, although I have to be careful with these, and I certainly couch them in particular ways and talk about the relevance to them. For example, today, one of the things I'm going to be talking about with my students is the role of gambling on college campuses, yeah. Which
interesting.
I only learned about really recently, but all of these gambling companies and sports book are making relations with universities essentially to entice students into a lifetime of gambling.
Yeah.
And a lot of my students seem to gamble.
I'm sure.
And I find the whole thing abhorrent, and I want to, you know, talk to students about that and have them see it a bit more critically, because I think that they are not really taught to engage critically with capitalism in the way that they might be taught to engage critically with something like civil rights or race or other things like that. So that's really my project with students.
Absolutely. And, you know, I think there's the gambling is a really interesting point, because I know that when I was in college, you know, 30 years ago, you know, gambling was basically illegal everywhere except Vegas. You couldn't advertise. I think one university now has named their stadium the Bet after a gambling website or whatever. So it's amazing. A university does this is incredible. And like, it's so like kind of, you know, predatory to the students mm-hmm. in a certain kind of way. It's amazing at how it's changed. I mean, I think part of the reason that you might agree with this, that these students are open to your message about anti-capitalism, because they are, you know, it's the intensification, as you say in the book, of capitalism, really. Mm-hmm. Neoliberalism is into a more intense stage than it was, let's say, 30 years ago.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And do you think that's why the students are more open to this kind of possibility?
Absolutely. I do. I think that there's an intensification of capitalism itself, and particularly students can see that in the expression of the university.
Right, of course.
Where, yeah. The gambling aspect is one aspect of this, but also the student debt issue, the rising cost of tuition.
Right.
There's so many partnerships with ed tech or
yes.
other kinds of predatory companies that students are, I think, inundated with all of these offers. For example, you know, back when I was in college, and this is in the early stages of this, a friend of mine was in a sorority, and they were trying to get people to sign up for these very predatory credit cards.
Yes. Oh, yeah. I remember that.
Yes. So I think students are just immersed in this, and there's a hunger to see some kind of critique. Although at the same time, I think many of them are inured to it, or at least they don't seem to have permission to really talk about it because it's so normalized for them. It's mm-hmm. present. But so there's this shift of capitalism, but I think there's also a cultural shift that is also happening, where there has become a increasing critique of neoliberalism, but also the hypocrisy of some organizations and corporations, which I think people are beginning to realize that a lot of the supposed progressiveness of either political leaders or organizations or the institutions is very paper thin at times. And so that there is this kind of insincerity when, for example, Apple's Tim Cook talks about we need to attend to race and racial violence, while at the same time that company is using, you know, foreign labor to... you know, create its product. So there is this kind of hypocrisy. And I think that students are aware of this. And I think that culture is increasingly willing to speak about this kind of issue.
Absolutely. Yeah. So there's like, it's a very sort of superficial in a way, as you say, like Tim Cook's example there. Whereas, you know, we're going to talk about this, but we're not really going to go to the root causes. We're just, we're going to do this as kind of a green watch, not green watching, but it's a way to kind of watch, yeah, economic watching, whatever you want to call it. But there's,
I mean, what's interesting today is that that was the sort of previous neoliberal model, the Tim Cook model, the Steve Jobs model.
Right.
And there is something new happening today in tech and in politics where there's this reactionary neoliberal turn. I talked about this a little bit.
Oh, yes, you do.
But people like, I saw the recent Republican debate, Vivek Ramaswamy.
Yes, yeah.
Is a tech leader of a kind, and he has come out and said, wokeness is the worst thing ever. All of these companies are evil that are making these progressive gestures. So there's this interesting thing happening between this older model of neoliberalism, which was itself fairly skin deep and insincere, and a new model that even takes this gestural acknowledgement of neoliberalism as unacceptable and wants to fully commit to a kind of predatory capitalism, a hierarchical capitalism. So you see that in Musk and Ramaswamy and Peter Thiel.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
And
yeah.
Of course, Donald Trump. So you see these two playing out in culture and politics right now. And it's kind of interesting.
It is very interesting. Yeah, it's a new term. But yeah, it's interesting. I guess it's got to be directed in some. This anger is directed and has to be directed somewhere. So it's kind of it's very interesting. Now the whole war on woke kind of thing. Very interesting. So just to go back to the book, who were some of the writers and thinkers that sort of inspired you to write the book or were influenced on you in the book?
So the writers and thinkers that really influenced the book, I mean, there's a number of them. Theoretically speaking, I'm working with a number of folks in the post-Marxist tradition who are thinking through writing and communication and knowledge through this anti-capitalist lens. So that tradition, which is not necessarily the post-structuralist tradition or the post-modernist tradition, but really a very contemporary set of theorists who are working with these ideas to try to think through a class critique or a capitalist critique of these various practices. So one of them, for example, is a really interesting philosopher named Bernard Stiegler, who he was a bank robber in France in the 1970s and went to prison. And in prison, he began reading Aristotle, and he essentially was radicalized toward philosophy while in prison, and he became a philosopher of media. And I use a couple of his theories in the book to think about how do we engage with technology in a profitable way when technology is so immersive. So he's got this theory of what he calls technics. And his idea of subjectivity is that we become fully a subject once we engage with various technologies. Books and films are very important for him, television, what have you. And society itself also becomes a society, a functioning society, through these complex interactions of individuals with these texts, with technologies, but also with each other. So you have people who are reading and interacting with other people and creating this sort of dynamic, kinetic society through their interactions with texts, with cinema, with theater, with various physical technologies. The problem in his view, though, is that with the emergence of digital media and with internet technology, all of these interactions and mediations are happening via these for-profit networks. So much of our interactions are happening on social media, for example, or over the internet. We're reading for-profit media. And so there's something that's disturbing our essential relationship, not only with these technologies that make us, but also with each other. So that money and profit and predatory capitalism has kind of, you know, it's in the mix. So there's something disturbing happening in the very essence of individuals in society. And his idea of a solution to this is what he calls dreaming. And I talk about this in the book about how to his idea of a way out is that we simply have to think faster than the algorithms. We have to think about what's the next thing. How do we move beyond the slow march of capitalism? How do we find new areas of connection or new areas of discourse or creativity? And we have to constantly be moving toward those. And it's a creative event. And I'm really inspired by that. And when I'm talking to students, and I have some assignments about this that I talk about in the book, when I'm talking to them about what a good world would look like, what an ideal future would look like, or a good society, part of what I'm trying to get them to do, and part of what I encourage students to do, is be creative and imaginative about, well, what does a good world look like?
Right.
Beyond these kind of the ways that we are shuttered or siloed in our realities of, okay, we are inured to capitalism and inured to student debt. Well, what would it look like if we could, you know, go beyond those and have a revolutionary politics? And I think students are not well positioned to be asked to do that. They're not being asked to have these idealistic thoughts. They're being, I think, educated to be very practical minded, be very career oriented, and they're not being asked to engage in these questions. But I think it's important. I think it's important for students in their lives to be idealistic, to dream a little bit, to be creative in thinking about what's a solution to their problems.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's something valuable that we can do in the classroom, to have this kind of creative, future-oriented conversation that gets away from all of the prohibitions that they are faced with every day, things that they can't do or they shouldn't do, or that they, you know, you should not want to major in this because it's not going to be lucrative, or you should not want this kind of life for yourself because it doesn't make sense. I think that we need to challenge that a bit, while also understanding that students need to make a living, need to advance in their lives and deal with society. It's important to include some aspects of creativity and imagination in there as well.
Right. So it's that the dichotomy between, like, writing it's a skill, you know, you're just going to learn a skill, but you're teaching it to be also creative and critical in a way. So there's this, instead of just a transactional thing, I'm learning writing so I can, you know, do a job. You want to have them thinking critically about the system and how writing is, you know, beyond, it's a creative force and it could be a positive force in the world.
Right. This is an important conversation in composition studies that has been going on for quite a while. This question of, do we benefit students best by giving them precisely what they are here for?
Right, exactly.
I mean, increasingly today, which is training. And there is a body of scholars who say, look, we do students a disservice if we try to shoehorn politics or anti-capitalism or anti-racism into the classroom, mm-hmm. in which students are desperately seeking some opportunity for economic mobility, social mobility, or some economic benefit from the skills that they're going to be learning. And then there's another conversation that says, well, no, these things are absolutely crucial and that we do need to be doing these in the classroom. I think my solution to this is that these are not opposed conversations.
Right.
Students can certainly get everything that they're there for in a writing class that's also attending to the issues of capitalism. And I think that what I'm interested in, and idealistically, I think, is, yes, I'm interested in having students benefit and be able to perform in academic context or in occupational context and doing what has been asked from them. But I also think that those asks, particularly in an occupational context, are increasingly predatory, are increasingly asking students to do things, to overwork or to do things that are not in their interest. And I
Right.
think that there's value in teaching students, for example, about what does discourse or persuasion in the context of a unionization drive look like. So, for example, I have students look at speeches by Chris Small sometimes and things like that. So discourse in the context of unionization, because I think that thinking about these questions of not simply what makes a good employee, but what is an emancipatory communicative act, is important if they might want to start a union at work or if they might want to get involved with a social movement. I think ultimately, I find that much more important in the long run, because I think changing those conditions is the only way that students are going to thrive, even though I think that giving them the fundamental skills of writing, communication, that will be useful to them, that's also important, but it's not enough. It's not enough anymore.
Because the world's changed so quickly, because capital's become more exploitative as we move on here.
Yeah.
So you referenced Chris Small's Staten Island Amazon, is that mm-hmm. correct? So give us some other examples of some assignments that you give students or exercises that you give students to get them thinking in this more critical way about
yeah.
capitalism.
The favorite one that I've done that I haven't done here yet was an assignment where I sent students, it was in Seattle at the time, I sent them to go and do field work on a number of different local events that were either anti-capitalist or anti-racist or rights discourses, any kind of political, emancipatory kind of political or social event. I had them go to these things. Some of them were museums, some of them were talks, some of them were marches. There was an anti-racist disco that nobody unfortunately went to. But I created an event calendar for them.
Oh,
I looked through the Stranger and made an event calendar for them over the course of a month. And I said, you have to go, I forget how many it was like 3 or 4 events. You have to go as a group, mm-hmm. and then you have to talk about it. And then what you will do is you'll do some field work and you will create, and I assigned them a couple of different options, but most people did a podcast where they ended up talking about the things that they were doing. And with this assignment, I think that's kind of typical of the book. I was really less interested in the product. I was interested in having them figure out how to do methodologically a bit of field work, how to talk about something that they were doing in a public context and putting together a kind of argument about that. I was interested in that. But the thing I was more interested in was having them actually have that conversation and have that experience and have it be a collective experience where they were together as a group talking through these things in this kind of collective communal way. I was trying to create these essentially little class communities that would be able to digest these things. And I got some really wonderful results. I had three guys go to, it was a meeting on campus about, and they didn't know this was an issue beforehand, but University of Washington uses prison labor to assemble its furniture. They didn't know that. And they went there and they were like, well, that's messed up. There's something wrong about this. And they weren't particularly political guys. They were into sports and into different stuff, but they all clearly had a reaction to that. And I had another group that went down to a museum in Seattle about redlining in the International District, which is a Asian, predominantly Chinese and Japanese district. And so they were talking about that history, and they hadn't really thought about that before. And they were, recording their conversations, thinking through it. And I really loved that. And I think that having that opportunity to work as a group, to discover something, to get outside the campus and engage with something political or social that's happening in the world.
Yeah. Absolutely.
And then to have an opportunity to kind of create something that's not simply a standard research paper, that's something that's a little bit more interesting and creative and fun to produce.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And I thought that, listening to that and hearing about groups, I think that some of the groups ended up kind of becoming friends. I mean, it was a great opportunity to kind of foster something beyond the typical do this paper, finish the class, get the grade kind of situation,
which
I think students are so focused on, which is not unimportant. But I think giving them that opportunity, this is pre-COVID, but giving them opportunity was, I think, a really great way to just engage them in some of this work and some of these questions.
Yeah, it's amazing about the University of Washington.
It's got a great history for that, and it's a good community.
I share that. Wow.
So, yeah.
That's amazing. And so, you talked about companionship or them coming together and becoming friends.
Mm-hmm.
So you referenced Jody Dean in the book, mm-hmm. the idea of comrade. Can you just talk about that a little bit? I thought this was really interesting.
Sure. Jody Dean has this really wonderful book. It's a short little book that published by Verso called The Comrade. And essentially, she's arguing against, although she doesn't explicitly talk about this too much, she's arguing against a trend in contemporary leftist discourse that is very fragmentary, very balkanized, which is essentially very focused on identity politics.
Right.
And
interesting.
Looking at these histories of marginalization and racism and abuse and disenfranchisement that have affected various communities, that's the norm right now, mm-hmm. to say we need to recognize this history and we need to center these various voices. And this is not unimportant work by any means. But what she's essentially doing is she's going back to a very old Marxist radical concept of the comrade, yeah. to say that what's ultimately important is a kind of solidarity that transcends various differences of identity, that doesn't erase them or fail to acknowledge them, but that says as a community, as a group of comrades, as a body, as a faction, we can be much more effective in fighting against what is ultimately the most damaging force, which for her is capitalism.
Mm-hmm,
and that once we find ways of creating these solidarities, then we can become a more powerful group. And right now she sees in the balkanization a lack of power, a lack of solidarity, a lack of kind of political friendship. And she's trying to address that. And she's working in the same vein, I think, that Angela Davis is, trying to find ways rooted in Marxism, but also in the histories of Marxism and communism in international United States, Europe, Africa, of looking to these coalitions or these groups, these international groups that found solidarity with other revolutionaries to try to work towards some sort of collective revolutionary intervention. Obviously, in the classroom, this becomes very modest, but I think that this is a really powerful idea that the left is getting away from. And I think that incorporating this idea is very valuable for students too.
Right, exactly, that they're all in this together. We're a collective, we're all connected. That's a beautiful concept.
Yeah.
And I like the concept that you gave the example in the book of Angela Davis, where she talked about when she was in jail, people from all over the world, you know, from different races and everything, different ethnic groups came and supported her.
Yeah, absolutely.
So that's that kind of brings home that concept of where, you know, we have to love each other, you know, to be. But, you know, anyway, we're just a Catholic broadcast. So,
right? I mean, this concept of love is really interesting. You know, one of the things teach and talk about in the book is the Port Huron Statement. And in that, Tom Hayden talks about this concept of love.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
And I've taught it a few times, and it's really confusing to students because this 1960s hippie notion of love, which is kind of, you know, has some clear relationship with the kind of notion of agape.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I like. Yeah.
Was a really powerful revolutionary tool. And there are other people who talk about love, and bell hooks talks about love.
Yes,
I mean, it's a very powerful, Alain Badiou, for example, also talks about love. And he's a philosopher I like a lot. It's this really valuable concept to think about love as not only a metaphor for our connection to other people, but also as a real existing thing that knits us together and creates a social bond that is, I think, at risk when we look at the effects of capitalism. It is certainly eroding these networks of political love or individual love by balkanizing us, by destroying communities or relationships in the same way that I was talking about with Bernard Stiegler. So there's a sense of something being lost, or the value of rediscovering love, even if it's some kind of dated hippie concept.
Right, exactly. And, you know, love has been so commodified, you know, in our society.
Exactly.
Most people think of love as romantic, but there's this other agape, as you say, you know, where it's like you teach people with respect and kindness, and, you know, to put it simply. But, you know, that kind of concept where it's about solidarity, it's about respecting other people. It's not about, you know, this sort of this sentimental kind of love. So I think that's important. That's important to underline that. You don't have to say it in so many words, but just to model that for students.
Yeah.
Can. And I think certainly that the idea of the comrade is a great example. So that's great you're doing that kind of stuff. What surprised you when you're writing this book? To get back to, you know, to kind of a podcast type question. So what surprised you the most, if anything, did?
Yeah. Well,
in your research,
the things that surprised me were reactions from students.
Okay, very interesting.
And I mentioned this a little bit before, but on the one hand, I was surprised by the way that so many students were game for this kind of work, even in places like, and I've done this work for a while, even before, as it was sort of long gestating. So I did some of this work in East Texas in my first job at the University of Texas at Tyler, which is a very conservative place. And nevertheless, I found that if there was enough kind of framing put on a conversation saying, I'm a liberal, well, I'll put my cards on the table.
Right.
You guys probably realize that.
Right.
And this is the kind of conversation that many liberals have, but we're going to talk about some issues, and there are, you know, multiple ways to understand these things, but we would talk about supply chain issues and labor there was at the time, I taught a Vice article about a fire in Indonesia that killed garment workers and traced out the line of a garment from the Indonesian sweatshop to the Target store where students might buy it. And we looked at the different process of and the questions I was trying to ask students were, what are our responsibilities for this? Do we as a consumer have some sort of responsibility to do something, to know something? What can we do? What should we do? Right. And they were willing to talk about that. So the gameness of students was interesting, but also what students were resistant to or uncomfortable with was also surprising.
Right.
And I talk about this with respect to student debt, which students are extremely uncomfortable talking about because, as I came to find out, it is and I should have expected this, I suppose, but it's so emotionally charged
because
of the way that death functions in society, and in fact has always functioned as a kind of moral register. And David Graeber talks about this in his book about death. I mentioned this in the book, but that death has become, that really has always been, this kind of moralization. Debt is always constructed as a kind of moral debt in addition to being an economic debt. And so when we have debt, we are always meant to feel subordinated. We are always meant to feel incomplete, or that we have essentially sinned in a certain sense. And so students carry that around with them and are very willing, unwilling to talk about it, to analyze it. And so getting that conversation going, and it, my work there was an attempt to try to look at this analytically and look at it as a structural condition of our capitalist moment and the way that we encounter the university, and to get students in that conversation and in that analysis, rather than simply see it as a kind of state of nature, an eternal kind of thing, and B, to see it as, I'm guilty somehow because I am in debt, or because I didn't get I didn't have enough money to pay for it outright, or my parents didn't, I didn't get a scholarship to pay for college. And so all of these things are, students are carrying these things around with them. And it also certainly informs the way that students approach their career as a way of getting out of debt, as a way of liberating themselves.
Right.
And so I talk about Annie McClanahan a little bit in the book, and she's a great scholar. I think she's at Irvine now. But she writes about debt as this kind of, that it has this disingenuous aspect, because particularly with respect to students, its rhetoric is that it's temporary, right? It's a phase that we go through, and I think students are very inured to that. And her final point, which she ends her great book on debt with, is this idea that if we accept debt as, no, it's actually a permanent condition that's foisted upon us.
Yes, absolutely.
Its temporariness is actually, it's a lie. Then we begin to get some freedom and agency with respect to fighting our condition, but only by acknowledging the disingenuousness of that argument that we begin to get that power.
Exactly, I think you put that in the book. You talk about how, you know, the indebtedness, how the devils have risen over the last 50 years, let's say.
Exactly, since the 1970s, it's become. And I don't think students realize this.
That's a beautiful.
Their parents' generation, you know, people who went to school even in the 90s.
Yes.
When you and I went to school, that was operative, but it was still far less than it is now.
Yeah, we know that.
And then in the 70s, you could be a waiter, or you could have a working class job, even a part time job. My dad answered phones at night a few nights a week and put himself through college at the University of Texas. That was doable.
Right. That's not
so profoundly not today.
No, not at all. Not at all. Yeah, always. I remember when I was younger, people telling me, you know, with all the people that meet at the time, oh, yeah, you know, I went to college. I waited tables. I drove a taxi and, I got through college and no debt. And I'm thinking, why can't it? And basically, I kind of did what your students did. Well, what's wrong with me? Why can't that work for me? You know, so I internalized it in a way that it was my fault. It was my moral, my moral lack was the reason I didn't get through college without any debt. But
and there's an additional element here, and I don't talk about this much in the book, but I've talked about it a little bit in some of my other work. But it's concerning, and it's that because of the fact that this debt is so huge and unpayable, it forces students into the most lucrative ways of paying that debt off, which in some cases can be sex work or egg donation or other things that put their health at risk, or simply giving up opportunities that would otherwise have been that they would have chosen. Joining the Peace Corps or volunteering or taking some low wage job that they're passionate about. For a lot of students, these aren't options because they have that debt that they need to repay. So they're going to try and find the most lucrative way to address that. And sometimes this forces them into positions that actually don't pan out. Right?
No,
a lot of students have turned to computer science as a way to make money, go to Silicon Valley. But that ship is sailing or has sailed. And so that kind of gold mine, that easy solution, is no longer as easy. And so I think this adds to the anxiety I was talking about before. Students are really desperate to find some answer, what is the right choice here to get out of this situation. You know, and that's a tough problem.
Absolutely. Yeah. If everyone goes to coding camp, then there's too many coders and suddenly the price goes down for the value of your skill goes down. So exactly. Your salary goes down.
I mean, the fact that it's a camp in the first place is an indication that it has become essentially a kind of pyramid scheme or something that. The goods it's essentially aiming to offer are no longer really valuable when they become infomercial material or when they become something where they, you know, there's somebody in my field is working on this, and I have a lot of criticism of this idea that if we see this as an emancipatory thing, okay, coding camp, this can be this emancipatory thing. I think it's the wrong way to see it because it's this kind of get rich quick solution. It's the new Cutco or something, or the new Amway. It's this way of there's one thing you can do, but it's really simply a product of the predatory system.
Yes,
rather than something that's truly emancipatory.
Yeah, and this musical chair. Some people will, you know, benefit, but most people won't.
Right. So when it's at the back end, right, this sort of this end stage aspect, when it has transitioned into cities across America, and there's multiple coding camps, then it's over.
Yeah.
Right. The gold rush is over. It's only the people who got in the very beginning, who got any money before anybody else really knew about it.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. It's very predatory, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. All right, so this has been a great conversation, but let's start to wrap it up. So what's next on you? What's your next project?
So the next thing for me is billionaires, and I talked a little bit about this before. I'm working on a book right now that's essentially trying to understand how contemporary billionaires, who I see is very distinct from the sort of robber baron model of the early 20th century or 19th century, how they have constructed themselves in the popular imaginary, and how they use argumentation and rhetoric to defend their project, defend their legitimacy, and to essentially capture the interest and enthusiasm of so many people. So essentially, it's a book that looks at the different strategies that they've used to gain this kind of supremacy. So the part that I've just finished working on, or that I've, you know, it will be an article that I was working on over the summer, was about Peter Thiel.
Oh, yeah.
He's an interesting figure because unlike a lot of other people like Tim Cook, who we were talking about before, Peter Thiel has never pretended to be a progressive. He's always been a reactionary. He's always been either, he's a straight conservative, but before he was a kind of libertarian figure. But he's this person who uses, as I discovered as I was looking into him, this kind of, I call it a Pauline rhetoric. He uses this rhetoric that's very similar to Paul's letters to various figures, to the Romans, in which he is posing his model of reactionary capitalism as this kind of new church, this kind of new way of getting out of the old Hebraic model of kind of emancipatory progressive neoliberalism, and this new model of salvation, which is hierarchy, which is an absolute distancing of social concern of the political, and is only interested in profit, in innovation, and in wealth. Right. And that's this new model of kind of me-centric capitalism that he's trying to offer. So there'll be some attention to him. I'm looking at how Musk is using gimmickry at Tesla. Tesla cars can fart, and they can do a light show. And this, I think, is a kind of it's a kind of smokescreen for a lack of actually valuable public innovation or life-changing innovation that might have been offered at a more progressive or more democratically focused company. So that's essentially what the book is focusing on, these strategies of control and strategies of framing billionaires of wealth as geniuses, as legitimate, as deserving of their
right. Wealth. Exactly.
And it's a way to maintain power. And I think it's there's not a lot of work on this, at least in rhetoric. And it's a kind of essentially hegemonic discourse that really began when I was in college in the early 2000s and has only gotten stronger over the past two decades or so.
Right, that's a really interesting project. Fantastic. Yeah, I think Steve Jobs was sort of like, you know, lionized in a certain kind of way.
Yeah.
You know, I think, you know,
was sort of the sort of central figure of the new kind of model of capitalism that, a lot of people look to as this kind of innovator genius.
Yeah, and exactly.
So many people have emulated him to interesting results. Elizabeth Holmes, of course, dressed and spoke.
Oh, yeah, with the
There's this sort of fetishistic element to this, to emulate the patterns, speech patterns, address patterns of these kind of coterie of geniuses.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's our culture to a certain extent. All the kids, well, at least at Stanford, I think, they all want to be that. They all want to be this kind of innovator, genius figure. And
it's
that is
fascinating.
They don't want to be rock stars anymore. They want to be Steve Jobs.
Right, Steve Jobs or Elon Musk. And Elon Musk is a funny character, and you're referencing, but the Teslas, he didn't create that. You know, though I think
he bought the company, of course. He's the kind of person who's, and I don't think even effectively, I don't think his rhetoric is good rhetoric, but certainly he's, for a number of people, managed to create a kind of cult of personality around himself.
Yes, no doubt.
As a unique, strange, interesting, but special kind of individual who is going to save the world, who's going to save Mars. And that we need to just let him cook in order to survive. And it's remarkable that it's worked. I mean, that's part of my interest. It's that why
it is amazing.
Rhetoric that is so bad, that so many people see as ridiculous. Why do so many other people see this as the best, you know, the most fantastic thing that they've ever seen in their lives?
Yeah.
Why are they willing to die for this man, or at least defend him to the death online?
Yeah, no, it's interesting.
Why does this happen? I mean, that's the big question that orients that project.
There's a cult of personality around Musk and other people. It's interesting. And the funny part is they take all the credit for all this things that they have really nothing to do with. It's so interesting. Like Jobs, you know, those phones were built, you know, slave labor in China.
Absolutely. And he didn't even design them.
Yeah.
You know, the best thing you can say about Jobs is he had an aesthetic sensibility that he took from Dieter Rams, among other people.
Yeah.
And he was good at, or at least, you know, he was a slave, he was a taskmaster. He was extremely authoritarian, but he was able to put people together.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
You cannot, I think, make the claims that people like Walter Isaacson want to make about him.
Oh, yes. Yeah. I tried to read that book. So, great self-promoter is what he was. Really a great brand, a great marketer in a certain kind of way. I mean, Trump's very similar, though. You know, it's funny. He's like the perfect president for this kind of area you're talking about.
Yeah, I think that's a great argument. Yeah. I mean, Trump is not, and I'm interested in making this claim in the book, is that people see some vast gulf between people like Steve Jobs and people like Trump. Yeah. And I really don't think that there is one.
I agree.
They're both politically fairly aligned, more than most people would acknowledge, and they have the similar view of themselves, as they have to be seen as this kind of genius, innovator, or, you know, there is no politics, there is only this one, them.
Right, exactly.
And that's the only way that they can operate. And Steve Jobs really pioneered this model of the organization that I think that we see being emulated in all of these startups today and in the tech world. And it's dangerous because it's inaugurating a kind of anti-democratic culture.
Oh, absolutely.
With it.
Absolutely.
So people are used to this idea, this kind of potentate model. It's seen as normal. It's seen as exciting. It's seen as the way things are. They have sort of a cult leader and everyone else just follows. That's profound, increasingly the norm.
Yes.
Unfortunately. Something, you know, I'm interested in trying to talk about and maybe talk to students about too.
Sounds like a great project. We'll look for that. Maybe we'll have you on the podcast the next time. All right. And so where can you find the current book, The Anti-Capitalist Compass, towards an anti-capitalist compass?
So you can get it at the publisher. It's published by University State Press, which is an imprint of University of Colorado Press.
Okay,
it's also
interesting.
Okay. Abe Books, which I
Abe Books, all right.
And of course, if you must, it's also on Amazon.
All right. Very another example, I think, of what we were just talking about. And so what are you online anywhere? Do you have, like, Twitter, any social media that you
I'm
like
on Twitter.
To
okay. So, yeah.
Or X now.
Yeah, I'm on X. Not for long, probably, but at James Roche Daniel on X.
Okay, very good. So if you want to find you there, you can find you there. Yeah. All right, very good. Well, thank you for the conversation. I really appreciate it.
Thanks so much, Jay.
Had a lot of fun. And then we will thank you, Dr. Daniel, and we will wrap this up. And thanks for listening, Zet Forward. Please join us the next time when we talk to another person from the CNAL community about their work and how it benefits the world around us. Until we meet again, all the best. All right, thank you.